Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is the IDFA podcast. I'm podcasting with my IDFA partner in crime. We come to IDFA to see movies, and we also moderate chats after films, and we keep doing this, and they won't stop us, so we will continue doing this. And the man of the hour, of course, that I'm speaking of is Eric Hines, curator of film at the Museum of the Moving Image. Hello, Eric.
Hello, Nick. You're still in Amsterdam. I left Amsterdam a few days ago, and I'm from an undisclosed location in the United States, but you are still there.
It's true. It's true. I am here. True. This is a documentary festival, so I should put the facts and truth in front. But the extra time was just so we could see more stuff to tell you about. This year was like definitely full-fledged, you know, return to force. You know, I think a strong addition. Any general notes on IDFA this year or just in general?
I love the festival, and I love how it's a large festival. It is a market of sorts. It's also a forum. So there's a lot of, you know, talk about films in development, looking for financing. And for something that's so industry oriented, I do appreciate how it's a festival that I think is very well curated and pretty well attended. They're adventurous audiences that come out to a lot of these films. And it was nice to see that. It was nice to see audiences for films. And it's always nice to wander into a room, either because we've been assigned a film to see or just happening to take a chance on something that maybe sounds good in the description and discover things. It's like why you go to festivals. And I love that about IDFA, because it's just the discovery element. The batting average is higher if it's a smaller festival that's highly curated. But this is much bigger than that, but still comes off, I think, as, you know, well-chosen. I do feel energized by IDFA rather than worn down by it, which maybe some other festivals of this size might make me feel that way.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I think also part of it is it's in Amsterdam, which has its own energy, and your heart is constantly racing either from the films or from jumping out of the way of bicycles. So you are kept alert.
You're never really safe.
You're never really safe. They are the silent killers, is what I say.
And I will make one note, in fact, that the bikes are very aggressive, and I love a bike friendly city, but this is a bike dominant city. One thing has changed from last year to this year, which is that the Uber Eats and Uber Eats like companies have descended upon Amsterdam. They were definitely not there as far as I could see last year. And that is a whole other level of lawlessness and wanton driving. A lot of those guys go off road.
It's true. It's true. Profit motive is not a safety code. But enough about threats to our lives. We will now talk about a few films. And we thought it would be appropriate if we started with one of the prize winners. And that is Apollonia, Apollonia by Lea Glob.
Yeah.
It's such a short name that I can't imagine that I'd mispronounce it, but it's possible. And she's a Danish filmmaker. And this is, Eric, this is one that I think was a favorite for you from this edition.
Yeah, I think I saw it before you did, I guess maybe the first or second screening. Yeah, it won the international competition and first feature, and it was a first feature that was 13 years in the making. It's the sort of thing where the filmmaker provides voiceover, so she's present in the film from the start and throughout, and she, in a sense, kind of narrates you through chronologically the story of Apollonia, of the title. And it's the sort of film that you don't wish a 13-year production process on anybody that hadn't intended to take that kind of time. And I'm sure that made life as a filmmaker very, very hard to kind of keep things going in other respects while this is happening. But it pays off, you know. I guess what I mean is you don't necessarily want to plan to take that long. But if you do happen to take that long, you might be gifted with an arc that you couldn't have predicted because life takes these turns. Apollonia is, Lea says early in the film, like the most compelling person she's ever trained her camera on. And she's somebody who grew up in a theater, in a small, militant, leftist, bohemian community theater in Paris, and had that life of being the kid who sort of sleeps on the couch as the parents party through the night and prepare to perform. And she meets her as a late teen and just decides to film her and gets, in a sense, gets sucked into her life, falls in love with the theater where she grew up, gets to know her parents, you know, and gets quite close and sort of observes things quite closely That's well enough. And Apollonia is indeed like incredibly compelling and beautiful and complicated, as you might expect from that kind of upbringing. But she's an artist and also a lot of people's muse and is looked upon by others as an incredible personality, but not necessarily taken seriously as an artist. And so you're seeing her work really, really hard to be taken seriously and has the sort of finest education you could have in France and then tries to make a go of it. And, you know, it's not an infinitely long film. It's a little under 2 hours, which is impressive considering how much footage there must have been. And, you know, what might be considered the third act here is very interesting and not necessarily where you ever would have anticipated it going. And this character who I've talked to some who kind of fell for her straight off and other people who found her a bit tiresome. Maybe I was somewhere in between. But by the time this turn happens towards the end of the film, she becomes kind of like utterly unique to cinema in terms of what you get a chance to observe and what this female filmmaker gets to observe in this female subject and the degree to which their affinity only grows and their affection for one another only grows. And there's a sort of unplanned, as it should be, element to the way that filmmaker and subject, artist and artist, in a sense, kind of come together and mirror each other in legitimate ways. It's a lovely, lovely film. And had heard in advance that this was a highly anticipated film. I did not know about the project. It is a project that I think had made its way to IDFA at various stages in terms of funding. And so it sort of made its way through a lot of channels and a lot of cuts over the years. So it was one of these highly anticipated films that there was also that quite strong possibility that it finally got to the end and maybe it didn't live up to its promise. And clearly it has.
Yeah, I don't know if I can really improve on what you said, but I will gratuitously mention a painting I saw that I thought of while we were talking about Apollonia, just in the sense of having a female filmmaker with woman as her subject and what particular intimacy that allows. Yeah. You know how it is if you go into the Rijksmuseum or more modern art museum. I found this artist, painter, Therese Schwarze, and I found her work really interesting and I was trying to figure out why. And she did paintings of friends in her circle. A couple really caught my eye where it was just the gaze of a woman who was a friend of hers just looking back at her sitting for this portrait. And it just seemed so distinctive. There was a kind of a composure or self-possession. So I don't know, somehow I thought of that kind of connection or when you were talking about Apollonia and Lea Glob.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that there's elements of what you see in the film, and it feels like that too. I understand what you're saying. And there's something about whenever a film, when a documentary shifts location significantly away from the environment that you can fully imagine is the reason the film was made, or one of the reasons it was made was to sort of make a film in that sort of knockabout theater of that is in disrepair. In fact, is basically a squat at the point that the film is being made. And then you depart from that and it feels disorienting to leave that space. It's clearly disorienting for Apollonia, but it also invites a completely different air into the film. And so when she then goes to New York and then she goes to California, you know, maybe there's an attempt to find a new scene. There's an attempt to find a new space. And the work itself is her work itself. Her paintings change too. And there's like all of a sudden the things maybe that you're describing and seeing in that painting are kind of just not there anymore. So who is she at this point? And it's very specific to her life as a painter, but winds up being quite relatable. You know, like who are we in our 20s and 30s when we go to an entirely different environment? Like what of us is left? And, you know, will we find our people? You know, and in a sense, you get the sense that maybe the filmmaker and the subject are the closest each other gets to being with their people at certain points in the film. And that's certainly not where we start.
Yeah, this is a documentary we'll probably see surfacing elsewhere, I'm sure. That's Apollonia. Another film, which actually was a film that was one of my ones that I did a talk with the filmmaker afterwards. And I'm glad also that you saw it as well. Justin Alien.
I'm glad we're talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a fun one. It's a strange one too. The director is Hua Weicheng, and we're dropped in the middle of this, I don't know what you call it, like an amusement park, a place of international spectacles and attractions. Okay, I'll say it. It's something like Zsa Zsanka's The World.
Sure. Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. Yeah. And it's called Foreigner's Street, which I think is worth noting.
Yes, it's called Foreigner's Street. Yeah, it's like a collection of various international attractions. I don't even know where to begin. There's like the there's like the Jesus statue from Rio de Janeiro is there. There is a cluster of buildings where I think I could identify like a Chrysler building replica.
Yeah.
There is like a Thailand performance space. They have a train that goes through everything, you know, like any amusement park or like zoo. And there's like a wall, there's a like a boat cruise that goes through, and then just assorted like carnival style rides and things. Yeah, everything the whole family would need. But what it also has is what seems like a year-long inhabitant, Sun, which just looks spells like sun. And he is a guy who marches to the beat of his own drummer. He probably also, you know, has some sort of psychological distress, who wanders around and has these routines and phrases that he comes up with. He's a whole kind of his own argot, basically, which the filmmaker kind of speaks with him. And this is like a 70, 75 minute film at the max that's just keeping up with this guy's movement, keeping up with the kind of kineticism of the park, the otherworldliness of it. There are also lots of UFO-themed sculpture.
Yeah.
So that's a theme running through. I feel like I'm kind of losing the plot. But
well, it doesn't really have a plot. I mean, it's a thing, so I think you're fine.
But I have to say, I kind of adore this movie.
I did too. And there's something about an eccentric of this, a sort of performance artist eccentric character. And he's actually the anchor of the film. He's like, in some ways, the environment and the absurdity of that environment. And I do think, by implication, the kind of absurdity of a contemporary China is what's kind of like swirling and surreal. Whereas he's eccentric as he is, you get to know him. You get to know his rhythms. You sort of get to know his behaviors. And he's sort of anything but a fixed target. But he's oddly a comparatively quiet center, which is a very interesting thing. Because when you meet him, you would never expect that that is how you might feel by the end. I think there's a lot of, I mean, you've spoken to him, but I have no idea how free he was to speak or how free he felt like speaking. And I don't mean to force it into it, but I do think that this is a film that there's a lot kind of in there in the subtext in terms of what he's making of Foreigner Street and what he's making of what it represents.
Yeah, I entirely agree. Yeah, it's very interesting because, yeah, the environs are just kind of openly fake. You know, everything just kind of feels fake, you know, but it's the fakeness of like a mall or like any kind of like snow globe simulacrum, you know, and it becomes this weird critique, but you're not really sure. And it's not like pushing that. And yeah, it's fascinating that Sun is the person who seems in some ways unbalanced can seem kind of balanced when he's finding his own rhythms and his own way through the world amidst this kind of wasteland, this of modernity or so-called modernity.
Right.
So it's just a fascinating thing. And none of this is stuff that the movie is so much more keyed into, yeah, his own routines. It has honestly one of the like coolest openings that I've seen in a while to a documentary. Like the first shot is Sun is on a boat and he is facing the camera, but the boat that he's on is actually this small boat is just kind of cruising down this river, you know, which besides being like a literalization of the idea of like a stream of consciousness, because he has almost like a meditative pose. He's shirtless as he often is. And, you know, he does this thing with keeping his hand on his chest, which I guess is kind of a centering, I don't know, maybe even like self-soothing sort of gesture. We're just gliding along with him. And I don't know, it's just kind of an incredible way to begin the movie and say what rhythm we're gonna be following.
Yeah. There's also he lets you see pretty early on after that how moments like that are arranged between the two of them. It's not like he's happening upon Sun, like really like they're making a shot or they're making a sequence together. But, you know, obviously based on having spent time with one another and understanding Sun's rhythms. But you know, there are these moments you see the sort of the pre-moments or the post-moments for these scenes often where Sun kind of breaks character or shifts into a different mode. And it's like, okay, this I did the thing. Now what are we doing? I think one of those ends with him sort of changing registers in his voice and says, okay, can we go get noodles? Which is just lovely because it speaks to the idea that, yes, this is him, but also they're making a movie together.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the interesting thing also is that the filmmaker still is. He's a still photographer, has been his practice. And this is his first filmed feature. Mm-hmm. And he plans to make more. And he brings a terrific eye for composition, for color, you know, almost like a wide-eyed enthusiasm with what you can do with the moving camera. So if there's a chance to make like a naturally occurring tracking shot by hopping on a train, he'll do it. If he can like mirror or echo one of Sun's gestures, you know, he might do that. So yeah, it's, and in a place that has so much going on visually, that's almost exactly the kind of eye you want. And right. And then he also includes stills in the movie. Like there's one just incredible montage of reaction shots of people looking up. And I think they're all looking up at one of those rides where people are like hurled up, at, you know, in the air and then dropped again.
Yeah.
And I love it because first of all, it's this angle on people's faces that no one wants. That's why you never see it. It's the up the nose shot basically. But what he does with it, actually, there was something aesthetically really cool about seeing people's expressions like that. I mean, I have to say, like, I literally saw people's faces in a different way with this montage of these kind of surprised or perplexed or horrified reactions. And I don't know. I love that as well.
Good film.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's just an alien.
Yeah, like, there's another competition film.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about, which is Colette and Justin.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the ones you did a talk.
I did a talk with the filmmaker Alain Cassanda.
Yeah.
And this is his first feature, although he's an artist who I think he's in his early 40s, and he's a writer and I believe photographer as well. And this is a deeply personal film that is kind of an oral history film where he's interviewing his grandparents. They're Congolese. They're from Congo. He was born in Congo as well. And it's uncertain exactly how much he knew about his grandparents' past. I think he maybe knew some mythological strains or some sketchy elements that he maybe was involved in politics. But this is basically like, you know, they're in their 90s, his grandparents. And he spends time going through chronologically their lives from colonialist time, you know, to the sort of like the big changes in the late 50s, early 60s. And finds out that not only was his grandfather politically involved, his grandfather was involved in the sort of the main painful birthing of the Republic and the moment in which it almost immediately fractures after the liberation from Belgium. So it's archival and it's oral historical, but there's an essayistic element, a poetic essay element, which is his writing and voiceover, which is very good, uncommonly good. You know, you and I see these films pretty often in terms of the essay film or the film that uses voiceover to guide things along. It's not an easy thing to do, but the writing is really beautiful. And his delivery is beautiful and honest, and clearly not pretending to be in the present tense with the testimonies or the conversations with his grandparents, but conveys a sincere sense of surprise in terms of some of the things he's finding out. What he finds out and what the filmmaker grapples with is that his grandfather was not a follower of Lumumba, who is the sort of hero of the revolution and the spokesperson for it, and the one who's become the spiritual leader in the years after his murder of Congo. And so to find out that his hero growing up was an opponent of his own grandfather, who he also refers to as his other hero in life, is like a deeply complicated thing to have to navigate. And challenging his grandfather politically, gently and respectfully, but also kind of offering his own perspective here and having his grandfather have his very different perspective on things, and allows his grandfather's voice to hold sway as it should, but then hanging in the air is his own kind of reservations about it. Really interesting. Mm-hmm. And Colette, his grandmother, I wouldn't say she has equal airtime in the film, but she's given quite a bit of time to, in a sense, get across the point that his grandmother was the one who had a job the entire time. She was the one who was the breadwinner every step of the way. Oh, wow. And for this political movement to happen, you actually had to have people at home, women, working, putting food on the table, while this work of politics and self-governance could sort of be born. And then the fallout of conflicts around this was reclamations, violence, threats, and So the men who were involved with, who are leaders here, then either had to go quiet or exile themselves, which is what happens to this family. And all along the way, you know, it's the women who are employable in one fashion or another. And these are very educated people who kind of went hand to mouth for a lot of their adult lives. So just, fascinating, moving. It's not the prettiest film in the world. The sort of interviews are pretty bare bones, but the archival work is strong and interesting and essayistic too, in terms of some of the points he's making with what he shows when. So I found it really impressive and a valuable kind of addition to the sort of larger story, you know, the larger maybe tapestry of what documentaries have told about Congo.
Yeah, that sounds really, I'm really fascinated by that aspect of the work that also has to continue for all the other work to go on.
Right, right.
Did you glean anything from talking with him?
I mean, some of the background that I got from was just the process here, just in terms of how it was like, I think 5-6 years of conversations and then of archival research and then of kind of conversations based on some of the archival research. And, you know, sometimes these very personal films are just as kind of involved in terms of production as something that is more reportorial. And what about you? Any other films?
Notes on Displacement, which is by a Palestinian artist, Khaled Jarar. Maybe in a way it's sort of a similar case where it's the sort of movie, you know, you think you might have seen already that depicts the journey of family as they go through the turmoil and stress and pain of immigration. I think there have been at least a couple of movies about families, you know, especially making their way from Syria into Europe. And this is a family that goes from Syria and through a number of countries, including Greece and Hungary, making their way to Germany. In this case, the director goes along for the journey, but is already has his papers. So you're kind of constantly aware that he's in a different position than the people he's traveling with. So that's kind of hanging in the air. It's also a very like bodily shot film in the sense that he's really getting across the physical and, I mean, also like the psychological toll, but also just, you know, rumbling along in the night, these long walks, you don't know where you're going. You have to get to somewhere else and people are tired and you have to make sure everyone's all together. You know, so that's happening, you know, and they get kind of marooned for a while in Hungary, which doesn't seem entirely unrelated to the authoritarian state there. And then there, of course, there comes these moments, and you know, I kind of don't want to say exactly how or what happens, where the filmmaker kind of has to make a decision of whether he's going to continue and participate or try to change their journey and, you know, how he can affect the obstacles that are in their way or kind of leave. And it's not phrased that way in the movie, but it's kind of clear that, you know, he just finds himself in that situation. And I mean, there's personal backstory in terms of his own grandparents and what they've experienced. It's just a wrenching movie. It's also inspiring because the family is tough as nails and along the way, very eloquent about what they're going through in trying to encapsulate what's going on. There's this absurd sequence where this Swedish journalist catches up with them at one point and is trying to, you know, file his story. And he's carrying this ludicrous little umbrella while they're walking along in the rain along these train tracks. And it's just this perfect like foil to, you know, the filmmaker chronicling what's going on. You know, somewhat more engaged, obviously. So yeah, I thought this is a pretty moving documentary, like literally moving because they are moving throughout. But yeah, one I would recommend. And I think one that will travel, I suspect. But anyway, Notes on Displacement. I forget what section it is.
I think it was in the Envision as well. Same as Just an Alien. But that filmmaker, it's worth, I think, my mentioning another film by a Palestinian filmmaker, which is R21, aka Restoring Solidarity by Mohanad Yacoubi. This is a fascinating film. This is a follow-up from Mohanad's previous film, Off Frame, which was premiered in Toronto, I want to say 2016. And that film was an entirely archival film of Palestinian revolutionary films.
comprised of Palestinian revolutionary films. And that Mohanad's sort of approach there was that he, as a leftist Palestinian who was looking for any kind of historical support for his own, you know, desire for statehood, for independence, for justice. And Palestine had heard of the revolution, had heard of there being films, but had not seen any of them. And so he sort of searched around as an archival filmmaker and found these films as a kind of way of kind of like putting back into the public sort of films that he didn't have access to growing up, that had been sort of like lost into time. And in touring that film around the world brought him to Tokyo. And when he was in Tokyo, the story he tells is that a young woman came up and handed him an inventory, a list in Japanese, and conveyed to him that that was a list of films in an archive in Tokyo of Palestinian revolutionary films, a film sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. And the story being that leftists in Japan were looking for models for how to think about their own independence, and in this case, independence from America, which seemed to be, you know, a dominant force in Japanese culture, and then felt an affinity and an admiration for Palestinians. And this was obviously entirely new to Mohanad. And so he basically just takes this archive, and the first beginning of the film is him or a person going into this archive, stacking the films up, putting them on a cart and taking them out of the building into an editing suite to look through it and pick things out and show it to us. So it's more of a container film. It doesn't really have a narrative there, although there is a new voiceover and a new text provided to kind of thread things through, to sort of give a little bit of context for where these are coming from and why the film was being made. But it's this very tactile work because he's showing you films that were maybe made not by Japanese filmmakers, but then made their way to Japan and then got recut and had new voiceovers put in and maybe reframed in different ways. Or it's films made by Japanese filmmakers who were going and observing war or talking to people on the street. And it's an amalgam of all these. So the different textures, different, you know, some of it's like real beat up old films, some more television. And then there's that great layered effect of a film originally shot in Palestine, but done in English, overdubbed in Japanese, and then provided anew with English subtitles. That, you know, that experience where you've ever sort of seen a film internationally that's kind of made its way and had its own, accrued its own, like if you're going to see a Hollywood film overseas that has had voiceover as well as subtitles, that effect, which can be quite appealing for those of us who are kind of into like the film itself containing history. It has some great examples of that. Some of the films are really compelling. You may want to see the rest of it. Others maybe less so, but fascinating as documents. But it's a film where in some ways, moment to moment is less important than the concept of it and what it represents as you're watching. And yeah, Mohanad's doing something that nobody else is doing, and certainly not doing about this particular subject.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Yeah. It'd be cool if somehow, whenever that movie is shown, if there's any way to see some of those reels at a greater length or something. But I guess there's also, you know, not to discount, obviously, the editorial eye that goes into distilling them or and you know, compiling them.
But it's a way of doing that work that is less about, I'm going to fashion this into my idea of a compelling movie, you know, and more about what do I want to pick out? What do I want to show you? And how do I want to arrange it? You know, it's not thinking about your experience of it. Both of his films are short, you know, just a bit over an hour. But yeah, they're very much like a window is I think more the way he's looking at it, which I appreciate. Because it is, in a sense, you're almost experiencing a tease or a version of what it was like for him to sift through and watch these things.
Yeah. Wait, so what is R21? Did you?
Yeah, well, I didn't say what it was, but he explained that R21 is that there were 20 of these reels, 20 of these films. And he's considering this, in a sense, he was gifted with these films to look at and learn from and discover. And in giving back the archive these films, he was gifting them with a new film, and this is R21.
Ah, okay. All right, so yeah, that's R21, and there are still other movies, and I'm going to have to catch up on a couple here myself, but yeah, there are definitely other movies. I guess there was one short film. Did you manage to see Away?
No, you're catching me out on kind of my priority. It was to catch up with that. And I was such an admirer of Where We Headed, his film that won 3 prizes, I believe, last year at the festival.
Yes.
And very eager to see this new one, which did take home the shorts prize.
Yeah, me too. And now that actually makes me remember. I'm pretty sure that is a movie that we talked about last year.
Yeah.
The Moscow subway with a very memorable conversation between the Santa Claus guy and a inebriated fellow subway traveler, which I'll never forget. So yeah, we will watch Away, and I'm sure some other films as well. But we can leave it off there. Eric, thank you for patching in from your armored bunker 2,000 feet under the crust of the earth. We should explain that there is, in fact, a 30-minute delay in everything Eric has said, so it's going to take a while to assemble this.
I have faith in your editing abilities to kind of make it seamless in the end.
Thank you, Eric.
A pleasure as always, Nick. And yeah, until next time, and then also until next IDFA.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.